Peggy, she was still there when I made the move to work for Bill Janklow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now that was your move from working for the news to working for state government.
Right.
Yeah.
And
if I can ask about that, I mean, yeah. Obviously you spent the time you spent in Pierre from, you know, 85 up to 98, obviously you're covering Pierre, you're building a lot of relationships with lots of state officials. That's how you find out what's going on. What induced you to change from reporting on them to becoming one of them, working for one of them?
Well, it went like this. Janklow had tried to hire me several times, as had Tom Daschle, mm-hmm. as had Larry Pressler, mm-hmm. through Kevin Schieffer. So I had Republicans who wanted me, I had a Democrat who wanted me, and I had said no to all of them consistently.
Mm-hmm.
With Janklow, he contacted me again after he won re-election to his fourth term.
Mm-hmm.
It was the day of or the day after, I should say. And he came through Jeff Fox, who's now passed away as well. But Jeff approached me, and I said no. Then he approached me again, and I said no again. But I thought, why is this happening? So I asked around, and Janklow had a press secretary named Jim Sawyer, and Jim was moving to a different job, regardless, and that's what Jeff Fox told me. So I began to ask around among reporters,
mm-hmm.
would any of them want the job? Because I thought if I could have somebody in there, in that office, who is going to be an ally, or it would be great.
You stay as a reporter, get someone else to be on the inside, exactly. And then you're scooping everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, you and, schemer, you.
Well, the responses tended to be either they would just laugh at me. Or they'd say, "Are you crazy?" And then maybe laugh too. So after I'd been turned down, by any number of people.
By the people you were hoping to recruit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got thinking more about it, and I, throughout this period, I worked for my house. I still work for my house today.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm not, at a meeting, not at the Capitol. And the decision came to me to take the job as I stood moving clothes from the wash machine to the dryer.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember standing there and just thinking, my mom used to say that I didn't take risks, but I would every so often take a really big risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she said about me. And I thought, here we go. I'm just going to take the leap.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I had asked Janklow whether or not he was going to run for another office. And he assured me he was not. He was going to be done with politics when this was over.
Not just governor. He said, no more races after this.
He said, no more races.
Huh.
Later, obviously, he went back on that. But even that, and if I can digress a second,
sure.
Even there, he went back and forth about whether he should get into the U.S. House race in 2002, and whether he didn't doubt that he could win a primary, but. told him was that I was not going to work on any campaign. You know, the office I inherited.
This is the communications office,
yes,
or the press officer for the governor.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The office I then took over was horribly antiquated in that they still stood there and pushed in individual numbers for newsroom faxes, one at a time.
Uh-huh.
They had, you know, they had no email system, their blast email system.
And this was 99. We had the internet. We had the capability to
do
all that.
And we did. And so I frankly modernized the office.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an excellent, I see him as a coworker. He'd probably say he was my assistant, but I think he was easily my coworker, or maybe even my accomplice in doing positive things, but named Mike Mueller. And mm-hmm. Mike deserved all the credit in the world for, because he did things I didn't want to do, and I did things he didn't want to do.
Uh-huh.
And so we made for an excellent team, and we sort of found each other through time. And so for example, he would do all the tech stuff, and I would handle all the incoming call stuff. He would work with BIT, the technology arm of state government,
right.
And getting all these different devices set up and all of these different delivery systems established.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to worry about any of that. I could focus on what went in the news release.
Mm-hmm.
I could focus on handling press calls. And what eventually came out of that was Janklow let me talk for him. I remember Jim Sawyer saying I shouldn't talk for him. I should let the governor talk for himself. And Janklow said, no, you go right ahead, Mercer. So I had a good relationship with Bill Janklow as well. And we were, I don't want to say co-workers, because he obviously outranked me.
Sure, sure.
But he had an open door policy when it came to me. Anybody who was in his office got to see me as well, standing in the corner of his office.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only a couple of times, twice with Mike Rounds, when he was Senate Republican leader, and then once with Dave Munson, who went on to become mayor of Sioux Falls. And with Rounds, Janklow wanted to discuss why his bills weren't moving. And I'll just leave it at that.
And that was a conversation you were not invited to be a part of.
I was not invited to be part of. I was asked to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Mm-hmm. I understood that. With Muntz, Bill was looking for a guarantee on a veto vote. That was it. And then he just wanted to shoot the bull with Dave. So I understood that as well. Otherwise, I'll give you an example of how much freedom I had. Larry Long and Mark Burnett, Burnett was the Attorney General and Larry Long was the Chief Deputy Attorney mm-hmm. General at that time, and they were just jammed up on trying to do Indian gaming compacts, the contracts or agreements, and they weren't moving. And Jeff Fox, who worked for Janklow, was in charge of them as well. And again, they weren't moving. And so Bill Janklow had Larry Long and Mark Burnett come to his office. Mm-hmm. And they were sitting in these two chairs he had. And I was sitting to the side of them. And they were not clear on why I was there. And then as they began to discuss, or move deeper into discussion, all of a sudden Janklow just turned to me and said, Mercer, you know all these guys. And I said, yeah, I know most of them. Why don't you just do it? Why don't you just go and negotiate?
You as press secretary.
Yeah.
He's saying, go do something that doesn't sound like a usual press secretary duty.
It wasn't. And I thought the other two men were going to shatter their jaws on their chests. Their mouths were open. At any rate, I did it. And I just worked my way through methodically. I started with the Sisseton Wahpeton tribe and with the Flandreau tribe. And they were teamed up. Their lawyers were teamed up. Mm-hmm. And the Flandreau deal got done first. And Sisseton followed, and everybody else fell into place after that. I did this over the course of a couple of years. I ran into a couple of issues. Yankton, I went down there, worked with their gaming council on day one, picked up the Argus Leader on day two, saw these incendiary comments by a member of their tribe, and went into my next meeting with the warning that, fine, if that's what you want, if you don't want to do this deal, that's okay.
That's what you said to them.
Yeah, that's what I said to them, and they backed up. I said, no. We want this deal. I mean, we know that you're not giving us as much as we want, but we're getting more than we had. And generally, the pattern I had was this: we gave the tribes unlimited table games. Mm-hmm. And before that, the table games were part of either the 125 limit device limit or the 250 device limit. And so we gave them those without restriction because they created jobs. Mm-hmm. And the tribe understood that. Yeah.
Jobs for the tribes,
yes,
on
exactly.
The reservations.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they got that part. Number two, they could have as many slots as to offset the loss of the table games that were now not going to be counted. Mm-hmm. And so if you had five card tables, you got five more slots. So that was a minor part. But the other, and then the third part was, we simply, we had a couple of tribes, Yankton being one, I think, I don't recall which tribes they were, but we had a couple of tribes that had given up their, or that had refused to waive their sovereignty over gaming matters. Mm-hmm. And Janklow, having worked on the Rosebud as a legal aid lawyer, defending tribal people, he just recoiled at that concept. He said, well, they shouldn't give up their sovereignty. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that was a standard giveaway on the part of the state. And so we had those three key ingredients. And, you know, and the other part was, Flandreau wanted many more devices, but they didn't get them. But when I went to Lower Brule, for example, the manager of the casino said, I don't need more devices. I need more customers.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, our deal was done in a short time at Lower Brule. So that's, you know, one of the things I did.
Sure. It sounds like the negotiations went well.
Yes,
your,
they did.
Your boss, the governor, was satisfied with what you achieved?
Absolutely.
So did you end up assigned to any other policy-making issues, I guess, like that?
There were many of them.
Okay.
And I don't want to get into...
Sure.
...into what they were, but, one time I'll give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
One time I was in a legislative committee meeting and a Democrat, Maggie Gillespie, she was asking why these reports were taking so long regarding juvenile corrections. And nobody at none of the other legislators could explain it. DOC had some poppycock answer, and I just thought, well, why are they? You know, I was in the room, and I went back to Janklow and told him that, and he said, yeah, why are they? And we got a bill in, and we had Mike Broderick, who was a Republican, sponsor the bill, and, you know, Maggie understood why we had to have a Republican sponsor this Democrat idea. But it was a good example of the kind of work I did. Another one I did, and I was sorry to see it finally get through this year, mugshots. Mugshots were off limits to reporters in South Dakota. And the reason they were off limits is that they began as a way for the local jail to identify the prisoners that were in their custody. They weren't intended for use in the media or in the public. And that was an example of me walking into a committee with a stack of books, law books, and walking them through that history. And I had talked to the committee chair beforehand.
And you were speaking to try to prevent those mugshots from being made public.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And my reporter friends, found that abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought we had good reason to fight it.
And even jumping ahead,
yeah.
Even as a reporter now, like you said, they did pass a law this year making those mugshots public record, I guess, available to journalists.
Yeah, exactly.
You back with your journalist hat on, still uncomfortable with that idea?
I am. Mm-hmm. I was, I don't think you saw me cover it.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way. And the reason was this. What I saw was a danger. In that, Bush, George W. Bush, was president at that time. I forget which of his daughters was in the news, but she was in trouble, and they had her mugshot on TV, and I sat in the committee and I held up that picture that I'd gotten off the internet, and I said, "This is what happens." Said, you might think you're getting the bad guy, but you're also getting a lot of people who aren't necessarily bad, but made a mistake. And I said, the other thing is that you can have arrests made for the wrong reasons. You can have an arrest made for the right reason, but somebody digs it up 20 years later. And they've got that mugshot. And that, you know, I said, what we ought to do is require their defense attorneys to have a photo made of them and, you know, submit it for public use. But, you know, the legislators agreed with my point of view. At that time, nobody tried to smoke it out. You know, in fact, in Tom Henney's, who was the retired police chief of Rapid City, you know, he was dead set against me because I'd beaten him. So, you know, I had those kinds of victories.
Sure.
You know, as I succeeded, Janklo increasingly gave me more responsibility. And so eventually, you know, the press job was 10% of what I did. And,
wow.
I mean, and I'm using that as a relative number, but you know, it was only 10% of what I did, and the other 90% was policy.
Yeah, more of a policy advisor role, an advocate role, than just reading what the governor wrote. Or,
yes, exactly. And I became his confidant. And so that's why he would have me, you know, in his office when no one else was allowed, or almost no one else was allowed. And, you know, Pam Roberts, you know, she was the chief of operations, and she became, you know, she dealt with staff, I mean, in each department, and Jim Sawyer set up office in he was directly across from Janklo's office at that time, and so he became sort of the policy director, mm-hmm. or whatever, and then he had me out, you know, kind of freelancing.
That was, it sounds like, an unusual role for a person picked to be press secretary to take. You hadn't seen that in the previous administrations when you were covering, correct?
Correct. I only had a couple of press secretaries to model
right,
after.
Right, right.
So, you know, so I had Jim Sawyer, who was there when I began covering the legislature in 85 and 86, and he didn't talk at all. He let Janklo do the talking, and one lesson out of that was this: Janklo dealt from the top of his message pile, and so what would happen is, you know, we'd call, we'd want to talk to Janklo, and Sawyer would say, "Well, I'll put a note on his desk." Well, what I learned was that Janklo dealt from the top, or, you know, returned calls from the top of that pile and worked his way down when he chose to. And it could be weeks or months later when he would return your call. You know, we had a, and so I decided I was going to carry a pad around with me. And whatever Janklo said, wherever he said it, I'd write down what he said. So in that respect, I was still being a reporter, because when people would call me for comment as press secretary, I could say, I can't get him for you this afternoon, but here's what he said on that topic. And they would, did he really say this? And I'd say, yeah, he said it. And I said, I can show you the notes. And so the press came to trust me as much as Janklo trusted me. I mean, so it was a good equation.
That kind of leads, I was thinking about what you said earlier, that you distinguished yourself in your early journalism, perhaps with innovation and integrity. And you've already addressed how as Janklow's press secretary and Coom policy advisor, you certainly innovated in the office. You talked about the technology, and even there your note about, you know, noting down what the governor said and taking care of those phone calls in order, you know, innovating in the office to make processes work better. I think you started ahead there to talk maybe about your sense of maintaining your integrity in that office. Do you feel you were able to keep your integrity as a political appointee as well as you did as a journalist?
Absolutely. I quit. I once quit.
And quit Janklow's office?
Yes,
really?
I did.
You quit from the governor's office?
I sure did.
My goodness. What brought that on?
Well, his we had scheduled the World War II Memorial dedication. And as part of that, Janklow wanted an insert put together, a newspaper insert put together. And the so he asked the South Dakota Newspaper Association to do it. The arrangement was this. Janklow gave the Newspaper Association the freedom to do what they wanted as far as design and content, etc. He reserved the right to, I don't know if edit is the correct word, but he reserved the right of approval, and he could suggest changes. The Newspaper Association did its job and got the pages to me. I did my job and forwarded them on to Janklow for his approval. And but he was notorious for putting off things he did not want to deal with. And so he didn't want to deal with this. But he also didn't want to give up the right to approval. And so this went on and on and on, and the delay did. And the Madison Daily Leader was scheduled to print it. And we were literally up against that deadline. And I'd been telling Janklow he needed to get this done. And he, I'll get to it. And, well, he didn't get to it. And I continue to tell him to get it done day after day, and again he didn't get it done. And finally, I told him, you know what? I quit. I quit. I said I'm gonna finish this week and finish up what's on my desk, and then I'm out of here. And that spurred him to action, and he drove over to Madison and looked at the pages and made changes and got it printed. At the same time, he was calling back to the Capitol and asking the receptionist on my, over on our side of the hallway, whether I was still there. And she said, well, yeah, he is, but he's gonna be done. He says he's out of here. The last time he called was on a Friday, and that was my last day. And I was home on, I believe it was a Monday. And I got up and thought, I don't need to go to work today. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I don't need to go to work today.
Right. You hadn't made a plan before this. It's not like you've been talking with the Argus Leader again.
Yeah, no. And so... that was September 11 of 2001, and the first tower got hit, and I thought, that's bizarre. Wow. And then when the second tower got hit in New York City, I thought, I'm going to work. And
going to work
as in going
to the Capitol.
Going back to the Capitol.
The job you just quit.
I had just quit. And he came in, he called a staff meeting, he wanted to know what he needed to do. how he should handle this. He never said a word to me about quitting, about the fact that I had quit.
And had just returned.
Yes. It was all forgotten. Mm-hmm. And that night, during that day, President Bush banned all aircraft, all flights other than military. And then we got special clearance to fly on the state MU-2, or no, it was we got clearance to fly on the state's King Air to Sioux Falls to for him to make an appearance at the Muslim community center, and which we did. And I remember flying down there that night and thinking, you know, we're the only people in the air. Wow. You know.
And whose idea was that flight? Was that the governor's?
That was his. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, that was his. He was extremely concerned that people would take action against the Muslims in South Dakota over, you know, in retaliation for this. You know, later, a week or so maybe, he arranged for a TV special that would be broadcast by all the stations in prime time simultaneously. And each station was to contribute a segment. And also, we would host a discussion in the studio, and it was at Kello, if I recall, but at any rate, in a Sioux Falls studio. And we had arranged for a Sunni and a Shia, or Shiite, to be on stage.
And Muslims who lived in
Sioux
Falls.
Yes, who lived in Sioux Falls.
Okay.
Yeah. And he wanted me, Janklow wanted me to be on stage with them. And so there were the four of us. And we met beforehand for dinner at, I forget where, but, and as the two men began to lay out their rivalry between their factions of Islam, I remember thinking, this is going to be a disaster, which turned out to be true.
Because yeah, we're a week after 9/11.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. we're still there today. Mm-hmm. We're still fighting that war.
So do you feel, I mean, the interview or the conversation with those two gentlemen, did that maybe undo whatever the governor's appearance on September 11th did, that or that speech from the Muslim center?
You know, I don't think so. I think if anything, it probably revealed to South Dakotans just how deep this divide went.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember feeling, you know, uncomfortable as the evening went on stage. Not because they were doing anything, but just I could foresee what was about to happen. And it happened. It just did. And then we, you know, if I can fast forward on this conversation.
Sure.
To, you know, Janklow in year 4 or year 16, yeah.
Right. Year 4 of his last term, of his 16 term, of his whole gubernatorial reign.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, during that legislative session, he was still going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
On running for Congress.
Yes.
Hadn't decided yet at that point.
Hadn't decided yet.
Okay.
And I just said, you know, boy, you know, you need to make up your mind. Eventually, he made up his mind and he filed for office. You know, Terry Wooster had asked me, months earlier, whether he was running, and I said why, and he said, well, because my source tells me that he's rented office space. And I said, well, that's a, that, you know, that might be, but I think that's a fallback position. Whereas if he runs, he wants that space guaranteed. And because I knew he still hadn't made his mind up.
Right. He was keeping options open.
Yes,
he wasn't deciding.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right up through the end of that legislative session, you know, he had not made up his mind.
Wow. That's cutting it close. I mean, we've got, still, decision had to be made by end of March.
That's exactly
still at that,
that
point, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, he decided finally to go for it. He jumped in. And, you know, the crowded primary probably helped him.
Mm-hmm.
Had it been one-on-one, it could have been different. You know, I went to that office twice.
To the campaign office.
Yeah.
During the primary.
Yes.
Okay.
Once was on the night he opened it, and Mary Bisson was in charge of staffing it, and so she invited all of his office staff to mm-hmm. come down to his campaign office mm-hmm. and get their keys. And so I went down there because it was mandatory, but I then informed her that I didn't want any part of this, and I wasn't going to have any part of this.
Part of the campaign.
No.
You wanted to keep your
that's right.
just completely separate and just
yeah.
be his employee at the Capitol, but
yep.
not be campaigning.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other time I went down there was sometime in May. I'd been on a state trip, and you know, a trip inside of South Dakota on behalf of state government, and somebody handed me an envelope at wherever I went to, I don't even recall where, and said, get this to Jim Hagan, who was his campaign manager. And so I did. I tucked it in my blazer pocket and took it down there the next morning and said, I don't know what this is, but you take it.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the two trips to the campaign office.
Thinking about those trips, I'll give you two questions at once. I'm
yeah.
wondering, one, do you have a sense of what finally tipped the decision for Janklow to get into the race?
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess at the same time, what was going through your mind that made you say, I don't want to be part of this campaign? Because
well,
I assume you could have. You could have said,
oh, yeah.
Bill, I'd rather work for you on the campaign than work in the Capitol. What were the two decisions going on there?
Well, let me start with answering the second one.
Sure.
I go back to where I stood at the beginning when I went to work for him. And I was going to finish just as I had started, where,
mm-hmm.
you know, I wasn't going to work for him if he was going to run for another office.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I finished. And
his mind changed, but yours didn't.
No, exactly, okay. exactly. And then, you know, what went through his mind? I don't know. I think part of it was the fact that he thought he could win,
mm-hmm.
And then secondly, he thought he was stronger than the others. And there was an extremely crowded Democratic primary. And there was a extremely crowded Republican mm-hmm. primary. Mm-hmm. And he was the last one in, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the tipping point. So, now, I was still part of the campaign in the sense that I had to take every call
mm-hmm.
that came in. And, you know, one of the things that happened through the 4 years was I could tell when, we used to call it the Friday crisis. And somebody, one of the typically TV stations in Sioux Falls would call and they'd have some tip. And I'd say, no, that's not right, and here's why it's not right. An hour later, the second reporter would call. Oh, no, that's not right. And, you know, by the time the third reporter would call, I could begin the conversation by saying, well, let me guess what you're calling about. Is it this? And, you know, well, let me tell you what I told, you know, the two previous or three previous callers. And so, you know, I could deflate a story that way. Mm-hmm. You know, on the other hand, Jack Lowe had an incredible ability to dig holes for himself. And I can leave it at that. But, you know, and then the other thing that happened, for a while we had an editor at the Argus Leader named David Ledford, and a reporter whose name now escapes me, but they were part of the same Let's Get Bill Janklow agenda. And Ledford, the editor, you know, early on, there was a conversation he and I had on the fourth floor of the Senate, in the gallery of the Senate, and he referred to Janklow as Huey Long of South Dakota. And I thought, well, that's not quite right. But that sort of set the tone for, you know, what then followed. And they eventually went on their own. They went their own direction. The other side of that is Janklow had his time in the hospital, and I don't know that he ever told the public exactly what was wrong with him. You know, he had a pancreas problem, and I think he was diabetic. But I don't know. But eventually he became diabetic. Mm-hmm. You know, and he didn't, he wasn't 100% forthright with the public. He was 99%, but he left out an important, small but important piece in my mind. But that's about all I can fault him for. He had far more integrity than the public understood, or generally understood. But I think that was one reason why he had his political base out there. I think rural people, especially, understood his core values were akin to theirs, or at least his integrity was akin to theirs.
So when Janklow prevailed in the 2002 election, you had made clear, this is a 4-year gig for me. I'm not going to Washington. Did you make that clear even when he won, or did you think, wait a minute, the big guy's going, maybe I could go to D.C.?
No, I told him no, and I told him no.
So he asked.
Yeah,
he wanted you to come with.
Yes, he did.
He enjoyed the relationship, obviously, and wanted to keep it going.
Yeah, he really did. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he went to the point of calling my wife, and because he thought she was the boulder in the stream of information, to quote another one of my predecessors. But so, you know, it was a no. And so I had to find a way then to return to journalism.
And that was your intent.
You
wanted to stay. Is that what was drawing you? I mean, keeping you from entertaining going to D.C.? The idea that you wanted to stay here and be a journalist?
Well, yeah, actually it was. And mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's put it quite as straightforward as you have, but that is what it was. But I just didn't know what it was. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do next.
Sure.
I just knew I was...
What form it would take, or for whom.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't just the fishing on the river.
No, it wasn't. And, I mean, Mike Rounds put out a fielder out for me, and and I said no to him.
At that time, coming in as governor, yes, he would have entertained you continuing in the similar role.
Yes.
Even so, it wasn't even you wanted to stay in the Capitol in state government. You did want to get back to journalism.
I did. And I think today is proof of the value of that.
Stay tuned for part 3 of my conversation with Bob Mercer. Mercer will tell us what it means to him to have received the Distinguished Service Award from the South Dakota Newspaper Association last week. He'll also tell us about the health scare that could have kept him from being here to receive that award. All that and more next time on Dakota Free Press.